Greetings, couch potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. For this Christmas weekend, I'm going to be reviewing the films Jumanji, Welcome to the Jungle, Downsizing, Call Me By Your Name, and Hostiles. I'll also be talking about the best and worst Christmas movies with Alonzo Duraldi and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Mother. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com and on facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
Sorry about this, Ron Burgundy. There is no news today because I have with me in the magical studio in the sky, Alonzo Duraldi again, author of Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas. He's also the film's review editor of The Wrap and co-host of the Linoleum Knife podcast. And I brought him in on this Christmas weekend because I thought it would be great to have a last-ditch effort to enjoy Christmas and get all the celebrations out of our way and talk a little bit about his favorite Christmas movies of all time. And if anybody knows Christmas, it's him. He knows it better than he does his own Christmas shoes. Which actually, I have to ask, do you actually like the song Christmas Shoes?
Oh, that song is the worst. No, that song is dreadful. But the one good thing that we got out of it was the Patton Oswalt routine about Christmas shoes. And then though whoever it was who animated that routine and put it on YouTube, it's brilliant. So go look at that and it will make you forgive the fact that Christmas shoes exists.
Nice. I will have to check that out because I always hate that song. And, people then call me cynical and mean for that, but I don't care.
No, look, I am the biggest softy for Christmas anywhere, and even I can't go with Christmas shoes. That's just too much.
No, they did a movie of that, though, but you didn't cover that in your book.
Oh, yes, they did, and oh, no, I did not.
All right, well, I wanted to get your take on your favorite Christmas movies and your least favorite Christmas movies. I figure let's do a list of five.
For my number five, this is a film from not that far back. It's about 10 years old now. It's an ensemble comedy called This Christmas. It's about a family, you know, getting together for the holidays and sort of unearthing, you know, old resentments and new problems. But it's one of the sort of smarter American ensemble comedies, and it sort of launched this mini wave that we've been having of late of African-American ensemble cast Christmas movies. You know, after that, we had Black Nativity and Best Man Holiday and Almost Christmas. This Christmas stars Idris Elba and Loretta Devine and Regina King and Chris Brown. And it's a really terrific film, I think. It's smart. It's funny. And I'm the youngest of seven myself. So I definitely recognize a lot of the family dynamics in this movie and the notion of how when people come home for Christmas, they sort of revert to their childhood role in the family, no matter what they've managed to accomplish outside of the house.
All right, number four.
I'm going to goose this one up a little this year because it's a film that I had never seen before writing the book that I really fell in love with, and it is now available on Blu-ray for the first time from Kino Lorber. It's a 1944 drama called I'll Be Seeing You. It stars Ginger Rogers and Joseph Cotten. And, you know, sometimes we have this tendency to think about movies from the 40s or movies during the production code as being very kind of, you know, whitewashed and bland. And this is a movie that goes surprisingly dark. Ginger Rogers plays a woman who is in prison for having killed her boss in self-defense when he was trying to sexually assault her. But nonetheless, she still has to serve time. She gets a furlough for Christmas and goes to visit family. On the train, she meets Joseph Cotten, who plays seemingly just another GI home from the war. But actually, he is suffering from extreme PTSD and has decided that he's going to go out of the hospital for Christmas to decide whether or not he can live in the world as opposed to having to remain under constant psychiatric care. So they meet on the train. They both kind of, it is very dark. They kind of hide their secrets from each other, but eventually they come to understand, you know, who the other one is and where they're coming from. Shirley Temple plays one of her first adult roles as Ginger Rogers' cousin, wow, who is at first very skittish about having to share her bedroom with a convict, but then ultimately becomes very, you know, empathetic and understanding of the situation. It is a beautiful film and just so smart about human frailty and about empathy and understanding. And it's not a movie that people know. It hasn't been remembered all that fondly. And it's certainly not a movie that people think about as a Christmas movie, but I really would like to see it enter the canon. So I'm putting it on my top five list. I really want people to go check that one out.
Nice. Number three.
Number three, I'm going to go with the 1970 musical Scrooge. We all have our favorite A Christmas Carol adaptations. I mean, you know, the Alistair Sim one is great. The George C. Scott one, you know, Mr. Magoo, there are a lot of terrific ones out there. And weirdly, you know, a lot of people, I think, will sort of attach themselves to the one that they saw first, that they saw as a kid. Yeah. I did not see Scrooge until I was in my 30s. My husband showed it to me, and it just knocked me out. The music and lyrics are by Leslie Bricus, who I'm a big fan of. You know, he and Anthony Newley collaborated on the Willy Wonka songs and on, you know, Stop the World, I Want to Get Off, and a lot of stuff. But I just think it's a very energetic musical. It's a very kind of post-Oliver, you know, the streets of London are filled with dancing cockneys kind of thing. Albert Finney is one of the few people in the movies who plays young Scrooge and old Scrooge, and so I think that makes his arc more heartbreaking when you see him go from this young, vital, sexy Albert Finney to, you know, the miserly old penny pincher that he becomes. Yeah. And then the ending is this like glorious sort of 20-minute thing where they reprise pretty much every song in the movie. Scrooge is, you know, out in the streets of London, and he's, you know, dressed as Santa Claus, and he's buying turkeys and toys and, you know, giving out champagne. And it's just, it's exhilarating. It's a movie that I really just love a lot.
Excellent.
Number two, you know, I'm going to say Elf, which is a movie that shouldn't work for so many reasons and really does. And we live in this sort of age of irony where it's hard to make a straightforward comedy about a guileless character without putting a lot of things in quotes. And somehow this movie rides that fine line and kind of puts us in the pointy shoes of this complete innocent and puts him into a recognizable world and still allows him to triumph and sort of keep the joy of Christmas alive.
Nice.
At number one, because I'm not a stone, It's a Wonderful Life.
Yes, it has to be It's a Wonderful Life, which it wasn't originally a Christmas movie.
Well, it had a limited opening in December. It opened wide in January, but they weren't really thinking of it as a Christmas movie per se, although obviously, if you look at the opening credits, you know, they're done up as Christmas cards. So, yeah. I mean, they were aware that there was a Christmas angle to it. But, yeah, the whole saga of It's a Wonderful Life is fascinating in that it was, you know, it was Frank Capra's first film after World War II, after he'd been off making the Why We Fight movies. He launched an independent production company called Liberty Films. It was Jimmy Stewart's first film after the war, and he actually was still in real life dealing with PTSD issues during the shooting of the film. It was a massive failure. It bankrupted Liberty Films. It went into the public domain, and then that's why it was constantly on television for decades, and that's when it became a hit, and that's when people saw it all the time. And decades later, it became this sort of American beloved classic, but at the time of its release, it was a catastrophe.
Which is not uncommon for some of these beloved movies. Not everything's a huge hit, and it just gets found later.
I discovered that a lot in researching films that are in the book, and also a common thread is a lot of the movies that we now think of as beloved Christmas perennials were trashed by film critics.
Those stupid critics don't know what they're talking about, man.
You know, and I get what that's about. Like, you look at the reviews for Christmas in Connecticut or White Christmas, and, you know, the film critics are all like, oh, this is such sort of sentimental, you know, claptrap or whatever. But, you know, Christmas is the season for sentimental claptrap, and we crave sentimental claptrap. And so what makes it easy to sort of scoff at a film for its sort of emotional nakedness is the very thing that makes it a movie that we return to year after year. So certainly in reviewing contemporary Christmas movies, I try to be very conscious of that, and to be very conscious of the fact that while all movies are subjective and all movies have a sort of a built-in fan base or people who are going to respond to it in a really strong way, there's something about Christmas movies especially where it's like going to somebody's house and talking about how tacky their heirloom tablecloth is. It's like, no, they love that tablecloth. They got that tablecloth from their grandmother. It comes out every Christmas. They don't want to hear about that tablecloth.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing. If it's a movie that you watch every December and it means something to you and it has, you know, a special place in your heart, you do not want to hear about how it's sentimental or, you know, overacted or saccharine or any of that stuff.
Exactly. Yep. Now, the book again is Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas. You can get it on Amazon or any of your favorite booksellers. Author is Alonzo Duraldi. And thank you, Alonzo. We will have you back later in the show to talk about the worst Christmas movies of all time. But for right now, we need to go to a break. And when I come back, I will be reviewing Call Me By Your Name and Hostiles.
Thank you.
Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about some movie reviews. The first one I want to cover is one that's been out for a while. It's actually been out for, I don't know, a month or two. It's been trickling its way and kind of swerving its way through America. It did the New York LA run, but for most people in America, you haven't even had a chance to see this film yet. This is collecting a whole bunch of nominations and wins in its award season run, and that's all great. But I think it's important to talk about this one, and that is Call Me By Your Name. In the early 1980s, the son of a professor studying in Italy develops a relationship with his father's graduate student over 6 weeks.
So what do you do around here?
Read books, transcribe music. Swim at the river.
Is there anything you don't know? Boundless
by the time I cry. You only knew how little I know about the things that matter. Build your walls
around. What things that matter? White noise,
what an awful sound. You know what things.
Rolling by road. You're saying what I think you're saying?
Call me by your name and I'll call you by mine.
This movie is well shot, it's well acted, it's decently well paced, it does run a bit long, which is expected by this director. This director is not exactly a tight, lickety-split, move-as-fast-as-you-can kind of director. Now, I can appreciate the work that went into this movie, but I gotta say, it just feels a bit recycled. I feel I've seen this movie again and again and again. And part of, I think, what's causing the a lot of the hype about this kind of ticks all these boxes in an award season rubric. It's a well-beloved international director. It takes place in Italy. It has sort of enlightened people in the roles. You know, have these professors and musical prodigies. It has an LGBT angle because, of course, the Armie Hammer's character has a relationship with the son in this movie. So it ticks all these boxes. And I think that works for a lot of people. And then it's a well-made movie. I will say, it's a well-made movie, well-acted, etc. But like I said, I feel like I've seen this. I've seen the sexual awakening of a teenager or soon-to-be adult or already arguably adult. I've seen that a dozen times. And to me, that's so cliche. It's not like a new idea. That's my biggest problem with the movie. Now, granted, it's based on a book and it's existing out there beforehand. So yeah, obviously it's not completely original from the get-go. But the other problem I have with it is you can't ignore the age difference that's going on in this movie. And more than just the age difference, but the age difference is there. And I mean, to me, it's a gay, straight, bi. It doesn't matter because essentially both characters are bisexual, and because they show them in different relationships with women as well, or girls. Like the 17-year-old kid has a girl that he likes and is fooling around with. So that doesn't bother me at all. What bothers me is particularly the age difference in their roles. The kid's 17, and granted, probably in Italy, in the early 80s, 17 was of the age of consent. I don't know. I mean, I think it's a good thing. It's a badge of honor for me to not know off the top of my head what the age of consent is in different countries and cities and states. If you're somebody who knows the age of consent, you better either be a lawyer or you got to look at somebody and be like, why do you know how young you can go? But I'm assuming that by 17, especially in the early 80s, that this was not a legal problem in Italy. Armie Hammer's like in his 30s, but I think he's playing like 25 or something like that, 23. So he is just a couple years older than the kid. I mean, it's not a huge age difference, but I still have trouble reconciling the fact that people are out there lambasting Louis C.K. for "And I Love You, Daddy," having Chloe Grace Moretz, who's 17, and having him question the appropriateness of her as a 17-year-old with other relationships above 17. Granted, yeah, I mean, John Malkovich, the one he's worried about is like 70. But I have trouble getting away from that because I think that's a valid criticism of both films. And more so, I have a problem with their station, so to speak. It's one thing if you have like a 17-year-old kid and a 20-some-year-old man have a relationship just on their own. They kind of found each other. I get that happens. That's not as big of a deal as a professor bringing somebody into his home as a guest and him having a relationship with his son. That's sort of like a barrier that shouldn't be crossed. And has, again, has nothing to do with the sexuality.
and has nothing even to do with age as much as it is, that's a moment of trust. You're bringing somebody in. It'd be like if you had a family friend that visited or something and they started having a fling with your 17-year-old daughter. That would break a segment of trust, and I have a problem with that. I think that's one of the things. It's always been something I found kind of skeezy to have somebody use that position. Again, a position of power. Aren't we talking about that already? A position of power getting sexual congress for that. And granted, in this movie, they actually kind of bend over backwards to make Armie Hammer's character, no, we can't do this, no. But still, it's an inappropriate relationship, and that, I had trouble getting past that. But the other thing I didn't like about it, and again, this is me, it's very pretentious. It's about a stuffy professor and his student who's so enlightened, and his son, who's everything a stuffy professor would want in a son. He's a musical prodigy. He's well-read. He's free-spirited. And to the point that the professor at one point acknowledges he knows what's going on here, and he's kind of like, oh, that's the way it is. That's the world. We are enlightened creatures, and we can't get in the way of that. I don't know. I just, these are the things that I couldn't get past to actually enjoy the movie. So I'm going to have to say Call Me By Your Name kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
Wait a second. I don't like the sound of that.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Hostiles. This is opening, I think, in limited release this week. But I figure it's worth talking about because it'll just get lost in the shuffle later. An Indian killing soldier is put in charge of escorting an Indian chief back to his tribe in Montana.
Captain, you do know Chief Yellowhawk. The Army wants to be certain that the chief gets home to Montana safely without incident.
I've any idea what he shot? He's a butcher.
Then the two of you ought to get along just fine.
No, I've killed everything that's walked or crawled. If you do it enough, you get used to it.
That's what I'm afraid of.
Now, this one's directed by the guy who did, like, Crazy Heart and Out of the Furnace. So it has Christian Bale in it, who was in Out of the Furnace. And, you know, it's a beautifully shot movie. Always these Westerns look good. And it has some very good performances. Christian Bale's good in it. Rosamund Pike, as this pioneer woman that they run into along the way, she actually turns in a fantastic performance. And I'm not a huge Rosamund Pike fan, but I think she did great in this movie. And then there's a little turn by Ben Foster, who's actually quite fantastic in the movie. In a smaller role, Wes Studi plays the Indian chief. And I think that they have some good scenes in the movie, but it is very drawn out and it gets very drab. But my biggest problem with this one is what I have a problem with a lot of modern Westerns. I mean, there were these Westerns back, and you need to talk like the 40s and the 50s, you know, the golden age of Westerns. There was an optimism, there was a humor to them, there was a charm to them. And then after sort of the Clint Eastwood Westerns came out, and as much as I love those, everything just got dour and depressing and overly grim. And you see that now where you see a movie where you can't just everyone's just like, ugh. I mean, it just feels like an oppressive world. And I refuse to believe that there weren't people with senses of humor and lighthearted people in that era. Everyone's just, oh, hey, we're just here. And everyone's gnarled and grisly and has the world on their shoulders. And that's just, I don't think that's probably, everybody lives in a world that they live in and they can be optimistic and happy. The humor did not just suddenly appear in the 20th century. So this movie just, it feels very heavy and dour in it. And while it has a couple good points to make and some great performances, it does sort of just kind of swerve around. Ultimately, I'm going to have to say Hostiles kind of sucks.
It kind of sucks.
No, okay. That's it for the segment. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Jumanji, Welcome to the Jungle, and Downsizing. Welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies, our big fat Christmas show. We're going to be talking about a couple of Christmas releases. There's a bunch more coming out this week. Let me just let you know. I know Pitch Perfect 3 is coming out this week. I know that All the Money in the World's coming out this week. I know that The Greatest Showman's coming out this week. I know that Father Figures is coming out this week. I only have so much time on the show to talk about these. I wanted to get some Christmas movies in there, and we've got Alonzo helping out with those. And I wanted to get some smaller releases as well, sort of giving a mix. I'll cover the other ones later. And heck, if Father Figures completely disappears this weekend and nobody sees it, I'll just ignore it because I don't know if that's going to go anywhere. But I wanted to get like two of the big ones out now that are really being pushed and heavily advertised. The first one is Jumanji, Welcome to the Jungle,
Four high schoolers in detention get sucked into a magical video game that puts them in a dangerous jungle adventure.
I think we've become the avatars we chose.
Welcome to Jumanji.
This is a video game, which means we each have three lives.
Come on, let's go.
I'm Alex.
Watch your step in here.
So gnarly.
We gotta go! Get on my back!
Before I talk about this movie, let's talk a little bit about the original Jumanji, which came out, I think, 1995, directed by Joe Johnston, who ended up doing The Wolfman and the Captain America, the First Avenger. So I would have been in my 20s, early 20s when I saw it, and I saw it on VHS sometime in the mid to late 90s after it hit home video. And I remember after seeing it, I watched it like with my sister and at the time my girlfriend, we may have been married at the time, it was my wife. And I said, this was the kind of movie that if I had seen when I was 12, would have probably been my favorite movie of all time. I was just a little too old to fully appreciate it as a child because I was already an adult. But unlike Goonies, which I've always talked about, where Goonies was a movie where I was just like 2 or 3 years too old to really love it as a child, but not an adult to look at it as nostalgia, this was one that I could put myself in the mindset of a 12-year-old Kevin. And I thought it was great. It's a wonderful performance by Robin Williams and Bonnie Hunt, and actually a great performance by, you know, Kirsten Dunst as well in one of her earlier roles, you know, sort of a post-Interview with a Vampire. I did have that sort of sudden clinching of worry when I heard they were remaking it, because, you know, it's such a charming movie. The original Jumanji is so sweet, and it's fun, and it's an adventure, and it's totally steeped in the 90s with what now we look at as terrible special effects, even though they were very groundbreaking at the time, and animatronics that don't quite work, and, you know, it doesn't quite hold up technically as a movie, but the heart and soul is still there. And part of that heart and soul was Robin Williams. And if you could get somebody who has a charm and wonderful nature, somebody like The Rock, I think could do that. But there's something missing in this movie that was in the original. And when it comes to the new Jumanji, on the surface, it works completely fine as this sort of whimsical, silly, fish out of water jungle adventure that the family can enjoy. And the whole movie is hinged on the absurdity of everything, because you got the nerd who goes into the game as The Rock. You've got the big football player who shows up as Kevin Hart. You've got the sort of the nerdy girl who shows up as Karen Gillan, who's super sexy and she looks great in the short shorts. And you've got the pretty girl who ends up being Jack Black. And so much of the movie is predicated on them all being kind of completely playing against type within the movie. Their characters are totally different than the avatars that they have. And that's pretty much what the movie hinges on. And it has some great jungle adventure scenes and some good action and some fun moments and some silly irreverent things. And anybody who plays even a small amount of video games will get some inside jokes on kind of how games are set up and how the story is propelled. But this movie is just about that. The original Jumanji, there was something more there. There was an emotional core. Because the original Jumanji, yes, it was an adventure, it was a special effects movie, it was action, and it had the animals and all this cool stuff happening, but also, it was a movie about loss. It was a movie about a kid who lost his childhood, which was Robin Williams' character. It was about a father who lost his son and never gave up trying to find him and how it ruined his life. It was about how the loss of a child can affect an entire town. And it was also about the loss of these kids' parents, because if you remember the kids in the original movie, Kirsten Dunst's character and her brother, they were children who lost their parents in an accident. And so there's this through line of loss and grief and how we deal with it that is very prevalent in the original film. And that to me is what I remember. That's what touches my heart when I think about the first Jumanji. Yeah, the lion's cool and the elephants and the monkeys are fine. But it's that heart and soul that is missing from this one. That doesn't mean that Jumanji Welcome to the Jungle is a bad movie. It's just, that's what makes it not as good as the original. So while it's fun, it's still missing something. But for a family Christmas movie,
Jumanji kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about downsizing. Matt Damon stars as a man who shrinks himself down to 5 inches tall to take place in a tiny new community.
So the decision to
downsizing takes the pressure right off, especially money pressure. We live like kings.
We're dying to move. We're really strapped.
In Leisureland, your $100,000 translates to $12 million.
Wow.
I know this can put a pretty big dent in anyone's self-esteem. But downsizing is about hitting the reset button. Start all over.
Why did I downsize? Same so that I could be here, right now. I finally have a chance to do something that matters.
This is directed by Alexander Payne, and I think that's important to note because the guy has nothing but critical hits from Election all the way through to, Nebraska, I think was his last movie. He did movies like Sideways, and he's done a lot of, like, well-known, well-respected stuff. In a way, this reminds me of that Cameron Crowe movie, Aloha, a couple years ago. And Crowe has such a great history as a filmmaker, and critics tend to love him. But Aloha was such a flippin' mess. And I feel that the same thing is happening with downsizing. Alexander Payne has a great history as a director. And finally, he's made that terrible movie. The movie has an interesting idea, but it keeps shifting focus. I mean, throughout the whole thing, the downsizing, there's sort of symbolic things and allegorical things that you can look at to our culture, like our impact on the environment, our wealth and property is an impact on ourselves. It also looks at stuff like international relations and caste system, you know, modern caste system. And also you're looking at how, job markets, like when you go to India and outsource jobs to India and they can do it for pennies on a dollar, how that can affect. So it's trying to hit all this stuff. And it's not at all aiming. It's just this scattered shot, blunderbuss explosion of ideas that just go from scene to scene. And it also doesn't know whether it's a comedy or if it's kind of this light drama or if it's trying to be a science fiction movie. And not that you can't do those three things at once, because I just talked about Jumanji being this sort of action adventure kids movie with this real heart and soul to it. There is no heart and soul to this movie because it just keeps getting distracted. It's like trying to listen to a speech by somebody with ADHD that just goes here and there. I mean, I even said to the rep afterwards, I said, there are movies that you see where you think, did the different director direct this movie from scene to scene? I mean, the changes tone, not just from scene to scene, this movie, and like line to line, there are scenes that are supposed to be dramatic scenes that then they throw in somewhat of a crass joke. And you're so confused because you're trying to figure out, well, am I supposed to laugh at that? Am I supposed to get behind that? Or is that supposed to be, is that irreverent? I don't know. This movie is all over the place. And it doesn't work as a science fiction movie because it gets that premise, it gets them small, and then it just kind of, that just disappears. And it's only coming back for visual gags or when they need it to explain something. This is minutia, but I remember there's a scene in there where they're in a room and you see fluorescent lights. And I'm like, you can't make fluorescent lights that small. I mean, stuff like that they don't even like set design it so it looks like it's taking place in a miniaturized world. And so I don't know. It doesn't work as science fiction. It doesn't work completely as a comedy. And it certainly doesn't work as a drama or light drama. It's completely half-baked and has no focus whatsoever. So I'm going to have to say that downsizing sucks.
It sucks.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I've got Alonzo back with me to talk about the 5 worst Christmas movies and then the home cinema roundup featuring Mother. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. I've got Alonzo Duraldi, author of Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas, with me. And I got to ask, Alonzo, what do you consider the worst Christmas movies for whatever reasons you have?
So at number 5, let's say Santa Claus the Movie, which was the attempt from the producers of Superman to basically give the same sort of epic, heroic treatment to Santa Claus. Yeah. I remember the joke at the time, somebody saying, you will believe a reindeer can fly. It it's partially a Santa Claus origin story, but then it goes off in this whole weird tangent with Dudley Moore as an elf and John Lithgow as an evil toy manufacturer who wants to put Santa out of business. Yeah, it's just kind of a hot mess.
And it was a huge budget at the time, wasn't it, when that came out?
Very much so. Yeah. This was a very big deal movie, and I think they were confident in its ability to become sort of an annual perennial. And that's the gamble of Christmas movies. You know, if you get it right, you know, you will be on TV forever, you know, and you can sell special edition DVDs every year. But yeah, sometimes they just lie there, and this would be one of them.
All right, let's go with number four.
This one took some digging for me to find it, but I'm so glad I did it. It's a film called The Magic Christmas Tree. It is this insane little low-budget movie about a little kid who helps an old lady get a cat out of her tree, and he thinks that she's a witch, and it's Halloween, and he falls out of the tree, and then suddenly the movie is in color, and the lady is a witch, and she gives him this seed that if he plants it under the wishbone from the Thanksgiving turkey, a magic Christmas tree will grow and grant him three wishes.
Now they're just making stuff up.
Yeah, no, believe me, this is we're still in the area of sanity. And then the tree grows and it can't be cut down, but then it comes in the house and it talks like Charles Nelson Reilly, and it gives the kid these wishes that don't make any sense, and it's nutty. It's the kind of movie where when you look it up on IMDb, nobody in the film ever worked again.
Yeah. Like, you know, it sounds vaguely familiar. Did Riff Trax do a version of this?
I believe they have, yes.
I think I've seen it that way, yeah. So there's one way. If you want to get it, you can watch this movie. You can go get it at RiffTrax.com.
Yeah. They've also got Santa Meets the Ice Cream Bunny, which...
Oh, that's just insane.
Which could easily go on this list as well. Number three is Thomas Kinkade's Christmas Cottage. This was intended to be the launch pad of a series of movies based on the artwork of the Painting with Light guy, Thomas Kinkade. Yeah. And it stars Jared Padalecki from Supernatural as a young Tom Kinkade, who is unsure what to do with his life, but he's mentored by, of all people, Peter O'Toole, who tells him to paint the lights.
Was this a Hallmark movie?
This was a theatrical movie that then wound up going straight to DVD, but it was supposed to be an honest-to-God in-theaters movie. It is thoroughly, thoroughly wretched.
Got two more on you?
Totally have two more on me. Let's see. Okay, this one, if you have not seen it, you can watch it on the new season of Mystery Science Theater 3000, but they do cut the most insane song in the movie, probably because there's no way to make jokes about it without being offensive, but we'll get to that in a second.
Goodness.
The movie is called The Christmas That Almost Wasn't. Mm. Directed by Rosano Brazzi, who you may remember from South Pacific. He also plays the film's villain, Phineas T. Prune, who is a rich guy who hates Christmas and has bought the North Pole so that he can foreclose on Santa Claus. Santa reaches out to this lawyer to help him out, and they go through wacky escapades to try and get Santa out of legal jeopardy. The crazy part that I referred to that they cut from the Mystery Science Theater version is that once the now reformed Prune accompanies Santa on his trip around the world, they sing a song that is called We Got a Date with Children.
Oh my heavens.
Yeah, it's ugly to look at. The elves are basically little people in women's wigs.
The Santa's workshop looks like kind of like my garage.
It's pretty small, and veteran character actor Misha Auer is in it. It's just a weird, weird little movie.
Okay, number one, drum roll.
This one actually came out the same year as my book, or I totally would have made sure to include it in the worst movies of all time chapter. It is called The Nutcracker in 3D.
Oh my God, that thing is a crazy movie.
Yeah. It might have a different title on DVD, but whatever it is, if it's a Nutcracker movie with Elle Fanning, run away. And it's directed by Andrei Konchalovsky, who actually directed two of my favorite films of the 80s, Runaway Train and Shy People. Mm. It is this elaborately bananas take on the Nutcracker that somehow manages to find a role for Nathan Lane as a young Albert Einstein. Mm. And it turns the evil mice into sort of Nazi rats who... Mm. Burn toys to keep their factories going. So there's this weird, uncomfortable Holocaust imagery and John Turturro in a rat costume. And then Tim Rice created these sort of rap versions of some of the Tchaikovsky music. And it's just no, a million times no.
You know, I had a copy of this. I think I was sent by the studio to review. Now, they didn't screen it. If I recall, it was hidden, like aggressively not screened.
They screened it, but it was one of the very first movies that I ever had to sign a non-disclosure agreement about.
We
review it before a certain time because they were really trying to minimize the damage of this turd they had on their hands.
But it was huge, wasn't it? I mean, it was a huge budget. It was like, wasn't like $100 million or something? But it's like...
I think literally the first credit in the movie is not a studio or a distributor, but a bank. This whole thing has like, oh, we have some funds frozen in Hungary. Let's make a really pricey movie because we can't, there's no other way we can get them out. I don't know what the backstory on that movie was, but yeah, it all just smacks of being like having been made for all the wrong reasons.
Yeah, that one's crazy. You know, I'll give you that. That's hard to top as the worst Christmas movie ever, I'll tell you.
Although I have to say, Pottersville gave it some stiff competition. That I just watched that one. That new one with Michael Shannon. That's a doozy.
Wow. This has been Alonzo Duraldi, the author of Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas. He's also the film reviews editor at The Wrap and the host of the Linoleum Knife podcast. If you want a copy, last minute, he sells a ton of these at Christmas on Christmas Day. So if you want to get it, get Have Yourself a Movie Little Christmas at any of the booksellers. And anything else you want to plug, Alonzo, before we say goodbye for 2017?
Sure. Yeah. Check out a new show that I'm co-hosting at the Maximum Fun Network called Who Shot Ya? And I'm also over at the Young Turks Network on YouTube doing movie reviews and TV recaps on a show called What the Flick. Merry Christmas, everybody.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. The movie I want to spotlight this week is one that came out in September, but I didn't get a chance to see it because there was like screening issues and scheduling issues. And then it got this interesting little F cinema score and nobody wanted to talk about it. Everyone wanted to simultaneously talk about it and never talk about it again. And that movie is Mother, or Mother! A married couple faces tensions and the reality bending dangers when they invite house guests to stay with them.
He's a stranger. We're just going to let him sleep in our house.
Did you know he had a wife?
They've come here to see me.
You're insane.
All I'm trying to do is bring life into this house. Open the door to new people, new ideas.
I'm so sorry.
Get out of my house! Get out!
You give and you give and you give.
It's just never enough.
Okay, first of all, let's address this F cinema score. There's a part of me that believes that Darren Aronofsky deliberately went to go get an F cinema score. I think he deliberately said, I'm going to make a movie that nobody understands, at least in the mainstream. This film is not about a couple in a house. It's an allegory. It is a symbolic story about God and Mother Nature and that relationship, and then the human race. And it's very clear, and Aronofsky's come out and basically said that this is it. But it also has all this symbolism for, the artist and the modern mainstream critics and the masses not liking your stuff. So there's certainly a bit of Aronofsky venting his spleen, possibly from all the hate he got for a movie like Noah after getting so much love for a movie like Black Swan. But first of all, Darren Aronofsky has never made movies that were straightforward. Ever since Pi, which is his first big movie that came out in the 90s, he's never made movies that really make a direct sense. And that's kind of what this movie is done for. So don't watch this movie to just see sort of like a thriller. It won't make sense. It just, this reality bending dream logic takes hold. When really, if you want to watch this movie, it's an interesting movie if you know what the symbolic elements are. So this is one of those movies where it's actually almost worth looking it up. Javier Bardem being God and Jennifer Lawrence representing Mother Nature, and it's an earthbound film because everything, either she's either in camera or it's from her point of view, every single shot. And it's him making a point about humans' relationship with the earth and humans' relationship with religion and humans' relationship with worship and the frailness of human belief and the way religion can be corrupted. So there's a lot that this movie has to say that's actually very interesting. The biggest problem I have with the movie is it's too long. It had to be that 90 minutes at least. So it just kind of drags. This, I think, would have been a really neat, like, 50-minute movie, like less than an hour, but they don't release anything that short. So they had to make it 90 minutes. So it does have a little bit of padding in it. It takes a while to get to the interesting stuff. And That's my biggest problem with this. Ultimately, I'm going to actually say that Mother kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
And that is it. Next week, I'm going to be talking about the best and worst of 2017. Merry Christmas, everybody. Have a great weekend, everybody. And until then, have a fat time at the movies.